You sit down with your GP. You've not been feeling well for months. Fatigue that doesn't lift, brain fog that's become your normal, hair that's not quite right, energy that crashes in the afternoon, regardless of how well you slept. A general sense that your body is not firing on all cylinders and hasn't been for a while. Your GP runs some bloods. You wait a week, you get a message or a letter or a brief call. Everything is normal. Thyroid is fine, full blood count is fine, iron is fine, kidney function, liver function, all fine, all normal. And you sit with that for a moment because on the one hand, you're relieved. Nothing seriously wrong. Great. And on the other hand, you're completely bewildered because you don't feel fine. You don't feel normal. In fact, you probably feel the opposite of fine. And you've just been told by a medical professional with a full set of test results in front of them that everything is fine. So either your experience of your own body is wrong or something is being missed. And it's not that your experience is wrong. This episode is about what's being missed, specifically the gap between what a standard blood panel looks like and what functional medicine looks for, between what counts as normal and what counts as optimal, between being told there's nothing wrong and actually getting well. Welcome to the Good Health Podcast. I'm Nicole Good, certified functional medicine practitioner, author of the bestseller Optimal You, and founder of the Good Health Clinic. This episode is a practical one. I'm going to walk you through five specific markers, five tests or panels that tell me things about a patient's health that a standard GP blood panel misses. Not because GPs are doing anything wrong, but because the system they work within, the reference ranges, the testing protocols, the time constraints, wasn't designed to identify subclinical dysfunctions. It was designed to identify disease. And there's an enormous amount of territory between disease and optimal function. And that's where most of my patients have been living for years. I want to be clear about what I'm not saying. I am not saying ignore your GP. I am not saying distrust the NHS. I'm not saying that the markers that I'm going to describe are always the answer or a substitute for proper clinical assessment or those blood tests that you get from your GP. What I am saying is that if you've been told everything is fine and you know it isn't, these are the questions worth asking. This is the gap worth understanding. And I want this episode to be genuinely useful. Not just interesting, not just validating, actually useful. So I'm going to tell you not just what each marker is and what functional medicine looks for, but what to specifically ask at your next appointment and what to do if the answer is no. Let's start with the framework because understanding why the gap exists in the first place is what makes everything else make sense. So let's look at NHS reference ranges, the numbers that determine whether your result is flagged as normal or abnormal. They are calculated from population data. So specifically, they typically represent the range within which 95% of the reference population falls. So read that again. The range within which 95% of a reference population falls. That's a statistical definition. It tells you whether your result is typical. It doesn't tell you whether your result represents optimal function for your body. And those are genuinely different questions. And conflating them is the source of enormous clinical confusion. Think about it this way. If we measure a marker in a population where a significant proportion of people are, say, insulin resistant, which describes a large segment of the adult population in the UK, the reference range is going to reflect that. Someone with early insulin resistance may fall squarely within the normal range simply because their level of dysfunction is representative of average. Normal in this context means common. It doesn't mean healthy. Functional medicine uses different reference ranges. Tighter ranges derived not from population averages, but from the levels associated with optimal physiological function. They're sometimes called functional ranges or optimal ranges. And the gap between a functional range and an NHS reference range is not trivial. In some markers, it is the difference between a result that gets you sent home reassured and a result that explains everything about how you've been feeling. There's a second issue too, which is that some of the most clinically significant markers in functional medicine are simply not part of a standard NHS blood panel at all. They're just not tested. Not because they're experimental or unproven, they're not, but because routine screening was not designed around identifying the kind of subclinical dysfunction that functional medicine focuses on. So with that framework in mind, let's walk through some markers that I consider essential to a functional medicine picture and that I find myself wishing every patient had access to as a matter of course. Okay, so the first marker we're going to look at today is fasting insulin. And it is the one that I think surprises people most when they first encounter functional medicine, because it's absent from standard screening in a way that becomes increasingly difficult to justify the more you understand metabolic health. You've almost certainly had fasting glucose tested at some point, and you might get confused with these two. Fasting glucose is a standard part of diabetes screening, and it measures the amount of glucose in your blood after you've fasted overnight. What you've probably not had tested is fasting insulin. And the difference in what these two markers tells us is significant. Fasting glucose tells us whether glucose regulation has broken down to the point of clinical diabetes or pre-diabetes. That's why it's done on the NHS. Fasting insulin tells us how hard your pancreas is working to maintain that glucose level. So you can have a completely normal fasting glucose level sitting really comfortably within range, while your fasting insulin could be significantly elevated because your pancreas is producing large quantities of insulin to compensate for cells that have become resistant to its signal. That's insulin resistance, and it won't show up in that standard fasting glucose test or panel until the insulin compensation mechanism itself begins to fail, which may be years, sometimes decades, after that underlying resistance began. So why does this matter so much? Because insulin resistance, even in its early subclinical stages, has wide-ranging effects beyond your blood sugar. It drives chronic inflammation, it impairs mitochondrial function and energy production, it disrupts hormone metabolism. Insulin resistance is a primary driver of things like polycystic ovarian syndrome, and it contributes significantly to the hormonal disruption of perimenopause. It's also associated with thyroid dysfunction. It loads the cardiovascular system. The fatigue that so many of my patients describe, the afternoon crash, the inability to go more than a couple of hours without needing to eat, the energy that feels unstable and unpredictable, is very often, at least in part, an insulin story. And it will never be identified on that standard blood panel because fasting insulin is not on it, unless you're pre-diabetic or diabetic. So what to ask for? Request fasting insulin alongside fasting glucose at your next blood test. Some GPs will add it. If not, it is available privately through multiple laboratories. It's a relatively modest cost. We can do that for you if it's something you want to get done. You can just reach out to us in clinic at hello@goodhealthclinic.uk. Then we have a calculation. So the HOMA-IR calculation uses both fasting glucose and fasting insulin together. And that gives us an even more significant picture of insulin sensitivity. So it's worth asking about that reading as well. The second markers that I want to look at is a full thyroid panel. So this is the second marker, or like I said, rather, it's the second panel. So this is a group of markers. And this one I want to spend a little bit more time on because thyroid dysfunction is one of the most consistently under-identified conditions in functional medicine practice. And the reason it goes unidentified is almost entirely a testing issue. When your GP tests your thyroid, they test TSH, which is thyroid-stimulating hormone. TSH is produced by the pituitary gland in the brain and signals the thyroid to produce thyroid hormone. When the thyroid is underactive, TSH rises. It is the pituitary shouting louder to try and get the thyroid to respond. And when TSH is elevated above reference range, hyperthyroidism is diagnosed and treatment is initiated. That's the system, and it has two significant problems. The first is the reference range, again. The NHS upper limit for TSH is typically around 4, 4.5, depends on the laboratory. Many functional medicine practitioners and a meaningful body of research will consider that anything above 2 is potentially suboptimal. So the ideal range in functional medicine is 1 to 2. If you are outside of that optimal range and you are symptomatic, that's when we've got a problem. So a TSH of 3.8 is totally normal by NHS criteria, but it could actually represent significant thyroid insufficiency by functional medicine criteria. Same number, completely different clinical interpretation. So that's really important. The second problem is that most GPs test just TSH alone, sometimes maybe TSH and T4. TSH alone tells you almost nothing about what is actually happening at the level of thyroid hormone production and conversion. To get that picture, we need a full thyroid panel. So next, the antibody piece deserves special mention. Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is an autoimmune thyroid condition, it's the most common cause of hypothyroidism, is identified by the presence of thyroperoxidase antibodies, TPO, or thyroglobulin antibodies, which is TG. These antibodies can be present and significantly elevated for years, sometimes a decade or more, before your TSH starts to rise enough to trigger a diagnosis. In that window, you as the patient may have every symptom of hypothyroidism and be struggling, but normal TSH, and therefore no diagnosis, no treatment, no explanation. Now, another reason why this is really important as well is because it allows for early intervention. So testing the full panel, particularly the antibodies, identifies things in its early stages when functional intervention has the greatest potential to slow antibody progression and protect thyroid tissue. In these decades prior to your TSH changing, we can intervene. And at this stage, you don't yet have permanent damage to your tissue. So it is the best time to intervene. Waiting for TSH to rise is not the only option. It just tends to be the only test offered. Also really critical is that you ask for T3 as well as your T4. So occasionally T4 will be tested, sometimes only if your TSH is elevated. We want T4 anyway, but rarely is T3 tested. And we really want to get that done too, because what that tells us is how much of your T4 you're converting to T3. So T4 is your inactive form of hormone. T3 is the active form, which means the body can only use the T3. But 90% of what your thyroid produces is T4. And we need to convert that T4 into T3 so it can be used by the body. So if your TSH is normal, is fine, your T4 is normal and fine, you could be normal. But if you're not converting that T4 into T3, you're going to be symptomatic. So again, this is a problem. What to ask for? Ask your GP for TSH, free T4, free T3, TPO antibodies, if you can get them, TG antibodies as well. Some GPs will add these. Free T3 is harder to get on the NHS, and the antibodies can be harder to get on the NHS, but they're available privately. It's relatively inexpensive. We can send you at-home finger prick tests to get this done if you don't want to have full blood draws. But if you have got anything going on, any symptoms that you think, suspect, potentially thyroid might be involved, it's really worth getting a full thyroid panel. And if you've already got Hashimoto's, you've already got a thyroid condition, it's still really worth getting regular thyroid full panels done, because we can see what's going on in your body. It changes everything about how you understand your symptoms and how you manage a condition. So next, we're going to have a look at a marker called hsCRP. So this is high sensitivity CRP. And it is, in my view, probably one of the most underused tools in preventative and functional medicine. Understanding the difference between the standard CRP, which you may have seen on blood tests, and hsCRP is the key to understanding why so much chronic inflammation goes completely undetected. CRP, which is C-reactive protein, it's an inflammatory marker produced by the liver in response to inflammation. Standard CRP testing, as performed on most routine blood panels, is calibrated to detect acute inflammation, the kind that's associated with active infection or active injury or serious inflammatory conditions. So it's a blunt instrument. It's designed to answer the question, is there major inflammation happening right now in response to something going on in the body? hsCRP, so high sensitivity CRP, uses a much more sensitive assay that can detect the low levels of CRP associated with chronic low-grade inflammation. So the kind that produces no obvious symptoms in the short term, but that sustained over months and years, is now established as a primary driver of cardiovascular diseases, metabolic diseases, neurological decline, and autoimmune progression. So if you've been listening to the last few episodes of this podcast, the last three episodes to be precise, you will recognize the significance of this immediately. The gut immune dysregulation that we covered in three episodes ago, the HPA axis disruption that we covered two episodes ago, and the stress autoimmunity mechanisms that we covered in the last episode. All of them produce measurable increases in circulating inflammatory markers. And we'll link all of those episodes in the show notes below this one. hsCRP is the way that we see that inflammation on a blood test. So we can use, and I use hsCRP as a tracking marker as much as a diagnostic one. So it can tell us how a patient's inflammatory load is responding to the interventions we're making. When a gut protocol is working, when the adrenal support is landing, when the anti-inflammatory dietary changes are having an effect, hsCRP will move. Your CRP wouldn't, but hsCRP will move. It's one of the clearest windows into whether the work that you're actually doing is what you need to do, is what your body needs. So what to ask for? hsCRP. It's available on the NHS. Some GPs will add it on the standard panel. If not, it is one of the most least expensive private tests available. So given its significance clinically, both for cardiovascular risk, for identifying chronic inflammatory load, it's worth having a baseline data on this. You can ask for it specifically by name, as standard CRP is not the same test. So make sure you say hsCRP. And again, if this is something that your GP won't add, although most often they probably will with this one, it is something that we can do for you privately. So the next marker that I want to discuss is ferritin. And this is probably one that you have seen or heard of, but it's possibly the one where the gap between normal and optimal causes the most widespread and unnecessary suffering. And I say that with some conviction because of the number of patients I've seen who have been told that their iron is fine while living with this profound iron-related fatigue or hair loss or poor exercise tolerance. And all of these things are genuinely there and they are an iron problem, but they've been told that their iron is normal. And this difference between normal and optimal is really remarkable with this marker. So ferritin is the storage form of iron. It tells you not just how much iron is circulating in your blood right now, but how much your body has in reserve. And it is the reserve that matters most for how you feel. So hemoglobin, that's the marker that determines whether or not you have anemia, can be entirely normal, while ferritin can be significantly depleted. So this is called iron deficiency without anemia. And it's extraordinarily common, particularly in premenopausal women or in people with gut absorption problems. It's also in athletes, it's a problem, and in anyone who's got chronic low-grade inflammation. So a vast majority of the public, and you don't need to be anemic to feel profoundly iron depleted. And standard blood panels primarily are screening for that anemia, not iron deficiency without anemia. Also, a lot of people, a lot of women particularly, are coming through clinic with hair loss. And hair loss is a ferritin symptom. And it is quite clinically striking in terms of how consistently hair loss or the hair can respond to ferritin repletion. So diffuse hair thinning, not the patchy loss of alopecia, but the general reduction in volume and density that so many women experiencing and are told is hormonal or stress related, can actually quite frequently be a low ferritin story. Not always, there can be hormone and stress issues as well, but ferritin can be a part of this picture. And it will continue until ferritin is repleted to an optimal level, not merely a not flagged level, but an optimal level. And the reason this matters so much in the context of this podcast and gut health that we've been talking about is because iron is absorbed in the small intestine and gut dysfunction, so the kind of dysbiosis, gut inflammation, and reduced absorptive surface area that we've been discussing, directly impairs that iron absorption. So you can be eating plenty of iron-rich foods and supplementing with iron while your ferritin remains stubbornly low because the gut is not absorbing it efficiently. So if we see low ferritin, we may need to work on the gut, address the gut, and the iron absorption improves. And this is another example of why the systems cannot be treated in isolation. So what to ask for? Request ferritin specifically. It's not always included in the standard iron panel. Sometimes it is, some GPs do it, sometimes it's not. If you don't see it or if you're going for a blood test, ask if ferritin is going to be on there. Ask for it to be done alongside hemoglobin and transferrin saturation for a complete iron picture. If your ferritin comes back in range but below 70 and you've got unexplained fatigue or hair thinning, ask your GP or a functional medicine practitioner to discuss the clinical significance of the level rather than simply the status within range. So that's really important for ferritin. So let's move on to the fifth marker. So the fifth and final marker is the cortisol curve. And this one I need to contextualize slightly differently from the others because it's not something that you can currently request from a GP. It's not part of any standard panel. I include it here because it's one of the most clinically significant pieces of information that we gather in a functional medicine practice. And I want you to understand why, even if accessing it requires going outside of the NHS system. So if you have listened to the last two episodes of this podcast, you will understand the central role of the HPA axis and cortisol in almost every aspect of the picture we've been building this month. That adrenal gut immune triangle, the stress autoimmune mechanisms, the wired but tired pattern, all of it comes back to how the stress response system is actually functioning. A single cortisol blood test, so this you can get from the GP, that's the standard measure of when cortisol is tested, tells you almost nothing useful about this. It tells you what your cortisol level was at the moment that the blood was drawn at one point in time, with no context for what it does at other points through the day. So it's like measuring your blood pressure once while you're in a clinical setting and concluding that you understand cardiovascular health, or running up a hill and taking your heart rate and saying, oh, your heart's fast. It's one point in time. We're not getting the context. The cortisol curve, measured through four salivary samples taken at specific times across the day, so waking, mid-morning, afternoon, evening, shows you the rhythm of the stress response, and the rhythm is everything. The patterns I see in clinic are really distinct and tell very different clinical stories. The flat curve, where cortisol's low through the day, with the blunted morning spike, is the pattern behind profound morning exhaustion, the inability to get going without caffeine, the feeling that you've got nothing in reserve. The inverted curve, where cortisol is low in the morning, rising in the evening, explains why a person who cannot get going until midday is most functional late afternoon and evening when they're trying to switch off and go to bed. The elevated curve, where cortisol is persistently high throughout, is the wired but tired pattern, racing thoughts at midnight, inability to downregulate. Each of these requires different functional medicine approaches to dealing with them. Addressing a flat curve is not the same as addressing an elevated curve. Looking at the HPA axis and healing the HPA axis without knowing the pattern is directionally underpowered at best and counterproductive at worst. And this is why I consider the cortisol curve one of the most valuable single tests in functional medicine. So what to ask for? Ask for a 4-point salivary cortisol test. It's available privately through many UK functional medicine laboratories. You may need to go through a practitioner. It typically has a cost of around £140. Some start a little bit cheaper. Depending on the panel, we can get a couple of other markers included with it, but somewhere between, say, £80 and £150. It can be ordered through a functional medicine practitioner, and it can really help you to recognize those HPA dysfunction patterns that we've talked about over the last few episodes. And you really want to understand your specific picture before intervening. So this test is really worth prioritizing. I want to give you something really concrete before I let you go from this episode, because information about what exists is only useful if you know how to actually get it. Here's what I would suggest asking for at your next GP appointment and how to ask for it. First, fasting insulin alongside your fasting glucose. You can frame this as wanting a more complete metabolic picture. Many GPs will add this. If not, ask for the clinical reason and consider requesting a referral to an endocrinologist if you've got symptoms that are consistent with insulin resistance. They won't do this unless you're really symptomatic. Second, free T4, free T3, and TPO antibodies, and if you can get them, TG antibodies, alongside your TSH. If your TSH has come back as normal, but you've still got the fatigue, the brain fog, the hair thinning, the cold intolerance, or weight gain that doesn't respond to diet, ask for a full panel. Quote your symptoms really specifically. If your GP is reluctant, ask what they would need to see to justify extended testing. Third, high sensitivity CRP, HSCRP, rather than or in addition to standard CRP. And this is a simple request, and many GPs will accommodate this one. The clinical case for HSCRP in the context of cardiovascular risk assessment and chronic inflammatory load is well established. So it shouldn't be too difficult to get that one. Fourth, ferritin as a specific request. Not just iron or hemoglobin, ask for the actual number, not just whether it was flagged. Get your reading. If your ferritin comes back between 13 and 17, you've got fatigue, you've got hair changes, ask for a conversation about the clinical significance of the level rather than just whether it was in range or not. And if your GP says no to any of these, it's not the end of the road. All of those first four markers that we've discussed are available privately very easily through our functional medicine labs. And predominantly, they're very accessible and very cost-effective. And then the cortisol curve, as we mentioned, that's not available through the GPs, but it is available through functional medicine laboratories. And we can get one of those for you. None of these are expensive testing. And I want to be clear, getting these tests privately is not the same as getting a functional medicine clinical picture. Tests are a tool. What they mean for you in your specific context and what you do about them, that requires a practitioner who understands how to interpret them functionally. But having the data is the beginning. You cannot address what you cannot see. So the question I want you to sit with this week is, which of the five markers that we've discussed today do you most wish you had data on? Not which is the most important theoretically, but which is the one that you think might explain something about your own picture that hasn't been explained yet? Because that's probably where to start. If you found this episode helpful, let us know. DM me on Instagram at Good Health Clinic. That's GOODE Health Clinic. Or email me on hello@goodhealth.uk. We can always cover more markers and testing in future episodes. The show notes for this episode include a reference summary, each of the five markers we've discussed, the standard range, the functional optimal range, and what to ask for. Save it, use it, share it with a person in your life who has been told everything is fine and knows it isn't. If you want to understand the full functional medicine framework, all 12 pillars, what each one looks like clinically, how they connect, this is what Optimal You, the book, is for. And there's a link in the show notes to get your copy, or it's available in all good bookstores. And next Monday, we're closing out this month with something a little bit different. We've got an amazing guest joining me. Ellie is a nutritionist, gut health specialist, and host of Gut 360 podcast. And we're going to go deep on gut health. And I think it's going to be a really well listened to episode. Subscribe, share today's episode with anyone who has ever been handed a normal test result that they didn't believe. And I'll see you with Ellie on Monday. You've been listening to the Good Health Podcast. I'm Nicole Good, certified functional medicine practitioner and author of Optimal You. Find me at goodhealth.uk, that's GOODE, on Instagram at Good Health Clinic, and wherever you get your podcasts. Show notes and all resources are linked below. See you next week.